Despite the extent to which the fate of the U.S. dollar was also tied to the Iraqi oil showdown and jeopardized by failure, it received little attention in the American mass media. A rare exception came shortly after the U.S. incursion, when Newsweek described the bad blood between American and European, French and German, policymakers in terms of currency and monetary rivalry. The real clash was not over weapons of mass destruction, wrote correspondent Howard Feynman, but over the dollar versus the euro. Who gets to sell and buy Iraqi oil, and what form of currency will be used to denominate the value of the sales? That decision, in turn, will help decide who controls Iraq, which, in turn, will represent yet another skirmish in a growing global economic conflict. This, as noted earlier, was the third countdown. Major publications in Europe, much more candid, made frequent reference to the currency stakes, perceiving the U.S. dollar at loggerheads with the euro, in what the Daily Telegraph reported some observers calling a global realignment stemming from the Iraq War, which threw Russia, Germany, and France together into a new triple entente. As we will see, Russian President Putin had already discussed pricing oil in euros, not dollars, with German Chancellor Schroeder in 2002. From the U.S. standpoint, Iraq by 2002 and 2003 was a rogue nation, not just because of hidden weapons or attempts to undercut the United States in the oil arena, but also because Saddam Hussein sought to unhorse the dollar in the global financial markets. Closely on the heels of the euro's 1999 introduction, Baghdad had started trading its oil for euros, not dollars, a policy that became official in late 2000. There are no records, but Cheney's reported early 2001 plotting against OPEC may well have touched on the related peril to the dollar. Indeed, shortly after Iraq was occupied, U.S. administrators put it back on the dollar standard for its oil transactions in June 2003. Moreover, had the hoped-for flooding of world markets by Iraqi production been able to weaken or break OPEC, that would simultaneously have undercut any chance that Iran, Venezuela, and Indonesia might convince the cartel to drop the dollar for the euro, or a so-called basket of currencies. Although the newly hatched European currency had lost ground against the dollar in 2000 and 2001 as rising U.S. interest rates drew foreign investors, the euro gained in late 2002 as U.S. rates fell and Washington mobilized against Iraq. Some currency analysts in Europe, however, preferred to credit OPEC members' anti-dollar machinations instead of the U.S. interest rate changes. Venezuela, for one, promoted barter arrangements instead of dollar transactions in selling its oil to Western Hemisphere nations, in response to the alleged 2002 U.S. coup attempt against Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Iran's central bank began shifting its reserves from dollars into euros. When in 2003 the U.S. takeover of Iraq bogged down in guerrilla warfare, attacks on oil installations, and escalating U.S. military casualties, those embarrassments spurred oil-related plans by some foreign nations to move into euros. Pertamina, the Indonesian state oil company, had announced that it was considering dropping the dollar even as the invasion occurred. In June, the Prime Minister of Malaysia publicly encouraged his country's oil and gas exporters to price in euros, while the Iranian central bank shifted more reserves and suggested to Asian traders that oil be paid for in euros. Moreover, after encouragement by the European Union, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced, in a joint press conference with German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, that Russia was considering selling its oil for euros. Part 3 of this book, dealing with the U.S. debt and dollar predicaments, will extend and amplify these challenges. For now, suffice it to say that in 2002 and 2003, dollar protection posed a serious problem. While the U.S. Navy could dominate the Persian Gulf or the waters off West Africa, its battleships were not free to train their 16-inch guns on foreign central banks. Besides the oil peak issue, U.S. oil company reserves, and the dollar's fate, the fourth endgame reflected climate change fears ranging from sober to apocalyptic. Here, environmentalists were beginning to see a countdown. The late 19th century West had suffered its own environmental fouling, the reeking smoke and haze of industrial Britain, the tons of horse manure dropped onto the streets of New York City and London. But the 20th century, with its eightfold greater consumption of hydrocarbons and thousands of new chemical syntheses, massively increased the atmosphere's carbon dioxide content, which in turn trapped heat. One international response was the 1997 Kyoto Protocol, unacceptable to Congress and then the Bush administration because of the constraints it would have imposed on large-scale U.S. carbon dioxide emissions, while leaving nations like India and China unaffected. Climate change itself became a possible strategic and economic wildcard, even though the 2003 report by the Defense Department's in-house think tank, looking at a window of peril between 2010 and 2020, was dismissed by the Bush administration. The constituency that elected the Bush regime all but barred a serious response. Congressional Democrats had also doubted Kyoto, but the Republican Party's de facto hydrocarbon coalition gloried in its SUVs and generally scoffed at switching to a conservationist or environmental mode. Even so, the entrenched petroleum and automotive interests of Houston and Detroit, as well as the combat-focused U.S. defense industries, were relative sophisticates compared to the 30 or 40% of the GOP electorate who believed in the inerrancy of the Bible.